Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can tune into the show every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
I'm a Liverpool fan and I take absolutely no pleasure in watching City win the league yesterday, but you have to hold your hands up sometimes and say they played extremely well. And they did exactly that. You know, they were impressive throughout the season. That run towards the end to take the title, absolutely brilliant. But when Pep Guardiola says, you know, we have to thank Liverpool for what they've done, it's a little bit like bumping into your ex, you know, at a party and she's with some new man and he takes you aside and says, listen, mate, I just want to say thank you. What? Thank you, you know, for because if you hadn't broken up with her, I would never have met her, so really, this is all thanks to you. And you just go home and cry into a large white wine. That's what it's like. It's exactly what it's like. It's difficult to hear Pep Guardiola, like, with no irony and with no absolute sense of what's going on, stand there and say, yeah, you know, thanks to Liverpool. Really, thanks for nearly winning the title. There's been a lot of that today. I'm not saying I've had an enjoyable morning in the office as a Liverpool fan today. People waving bottles at me. I have absolutely no idea why. Someone asked me if I was rattled, particularly annoying. Liverpool fans out there, I'm sure you're not enjoying life today because much as we've had a brilliant season, we've been outdone by, you know, one of the best teams. And let's be honest, last summer when we were all sitting here talking about what we think the season's going to hold, the one thing everyone seemed to agree on was that City were going to run away with it again. Because everyone assumed that this is one of the greatest Premier League teams ever, there's very little we can do about it, and they're probably going to run away with it. But they didn't. As Guardiola says, Liverpool pushed them all the way. And let's not underestimate this achievement. Retaining the Premier League is a hard thing to do. They're the first side since Manchester United a decade ago to do that. And I think the difference is that in the last 10 years, there are more teams with an ability to challenge at the top. I'm not saying that United's achievement wasn't brilliant. Retaining the title's hard no matter what, because to keep a team together, to improve it, to replace what you lose, because you always lose someone in a summer, that's going to be difficult. So it's always hard to retain it, but I think this is more impressive because of the overall quality of the league. I appreciate that City and Liverpool have finished a lot further clear of third and fourth than you might expect. But there are still four teams there with the money and the ability to challenge, you know, given 12 months to change their teams a bit. I don't think they are that far away. In terms of overall quality, I think they're close. Sure, consistency is a different thing. And that is really where this team differs. They have a world-class player in every position, twice. Pep Guardiola can pick two completely different teams on Sunday and on Wednesday, and they're both very, very high quality. You know, we used to sit around and say, oh, where are their weaknesses? And we'd talk about left back, where they've got a World Cup winner, a former Real Madrid player, and one of England's pivotal World Cup personalities in Delph, Danilo and Benjamin Mendy. And we talk about that as their weakness. That's how good this City side is. Their weakness is something that's still relatively strong. And they've given Guardiola absolutely everything. He says he couldn't have asked for more from them.
No competitions with there. We fought a lot after 100 points and make back to back in this league, in this country, with these managers, these players. So make us so proud.
And that is, it is the players in the end. Much as Guardiola's brilliant and he's so demanding. And, you know, it's amazing. I was hearing that, I think on Thursday night, Raheem Sterling was at one of these awards dinners. Which one was it? PFA? Football? Right? I don't know. Anyway, he was there Thursday night, right? Last week of the season. And he turned up, picked up his award, did his little speech, and he left early. He didn't even stay for dinner. He said, no, I'm going to go off, get the train home so I can get a good night's sleep before training tomorrow so I can train at my best. It would be easy for a young lad like Sterling getting recognised for a brilliant season to say, oh, you know what, I won't drink, but I'll stay and have dinner and meet some people and have a bit of fun, you know, be a bit of a laugh. Sure, I might get home at 11, half 11, but I'll still get 8 hours sleep. I'll be fine. But this is what Guardiola has engendered in this squad, this absolute demand for perfection. And we talk a lot about personalities of players and personalities of squads, but what I think Guardiola has created is a personality where only the best is acceptable. Constant striving for perfection. They will go into this summer and say, well, we didn't win the Champions League. They're probably going to win the Premier League, the FA Cup and the League Cup, which is an astounding achievement on sheer volume of games. And they will go into this summer and say, we should have won the Champions League. That's what they're going to have to do. And yet when you look at what they've achieved over the last two seasons, there's no reason that they shouldn't be quite pleased with themselves. 198 points over the last two seasons. Now, I know the Premier League trophy is awarded over one season, but that's 26 more than Liverpool, who are second. So they are four games a season ahead of Liverpool, and a bit. Four clear games ahead of Liverpool, who are, by common consensus, the closest challengers City have perhaps ever had, bar United back in 2012, I suppose. They've beaten everyone in the league. The first side since Preston to claim at least one league victory against every side they've faced in two consecutive seasons. Do you want to know how far that goes back? 130 years that record goes back. They've also equaled the Premier League record set by set by Chelsea last year during the Centurion campaign for the most wins in a single campaign, 32. And the lead at the top of the table changed hands a record-breaking 32 times in what turned out to be the most keenly fought Premier League battle in recent history. I should say that that stat is slightly misleading because you can manipulate the TV fixtures to make the lead change over a weekend when realistically it shouldn't change at all. I'm sure if you sort of collated the games and said, right, if everyone had played at 3 o'clock, this is where the lead would have gone, then things might have changed a little bit less. City are also the first team to end a top-flight campaign with 14 consecutive victories. That breaks a record set by Arsenal in 2002. That wasn't a bad team, was it? And Liverpool's tally of 97 points would have been enough to win the Premier League every year except the last two. It's the highest runners-up tally in the history of the competition and the first time two sides have amassed 90-plus points in a season. Don't take anything away from this City side. That is an astounding achievement. And the fact that it wasn't quite Aguero in the last minute almost says something about this City team compared to that one. That was a team right at the beginning of a project. They were only 4 years into the Abu Dhabi ownership. Pep, of course, wasn't even there. They were only just preparing the foundations for what they now believe to be a dynastic entry into history, which is the Pep Guardiola Manchester City team. They've already run two in a row. You'd be a brave man to bet against them winning three in a row, and it'll take an almighty effort from Liverpool to beat them next year.
Love Sport.
Now, I can't pretend I'm happy about it as a Liverpool fan, but Manchester City are once again Premier League champions and, frankly, quite deservedly so. A man who has Man City in his blood and who had the pleasure of being there yesterday as well is Gary Owen, former City midfielder, who's on the line now. Gary, sore head, I imagine, this morning?
It's recovering as the day goes on, but yeah, it started off a little bit sore, yeah.
Yeah, I imagine. Tell us a little bit about the atmosphere down at Brighton yesterday. I know it's always better to win the title at home, but equally, it's kind of special doing it on the road because it's a smaller and more tight-knit group, I fancy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we took the full allocation we could do to our away game, and no surprising, there was thousands down there of City fans that didn't have any tickets. So I felt a little bit disappointed for them. Mm. But they wanted to join in the atmosphere. They wanted to be there. And, you know, when you think there was a lot of nerves, as you'd expect, since last game of the season, what was on it as well, is that when you look at it, we had something like 95 points before the game. Mm. I mean, to get 95 points and still having to win your last game just shows you how tough it's been for them this season. But they all came down there, they all waited, they was all confident they would get the results. Why did we feel confident? We were 60 points better than Brighton. So 60 points over a season tells you that really you're favourite to win that game. So we had to not play at our best. They had to play better than what they'd done all season. And when they got the first goal, there was a few jitters that was going around, certainly within the City end. But within 83 seconds, we'd equalised. Once we got the equaliser, it was only going to be one-way traffic. We got the second one before half-time. And the second half was a professional performance that you won't see anywhere at any time. We controlled the game. We played it. It was like a surgeon with a scalpel. He was just waiting to dissect when he needed to do it. And we did that quite easily when we got the third goal. And then Gundogan's great free kick for the fourth sealed it, and everybody was happy.
You mentioned the nerves in the crowd, especially when Glenn Murray got that goal. Did you sense any nerves from the players? You mentioned they were good in the second half, but early on, for example, I was watching the Liverpool game and they looked very nervous. Did City show any of that in the early stages?
No, because it's not the first time that we've been a goal behind. We've had to come back. We play the same way, no matter where we are or against which opposition, and that was the same as today. We knew that if we play the way we train, the way we've done for the past two seasons, then unless there's going to be some sort of thing that would happen that you can't get the result, we normally play our way back into it and eventually go and win it. But I mean, to get 98 points, to get 99 on average over two seasons is phenomenal in any level of football, never mind in the Premiership.
Yeah.
So for us to get 99 points over two seasons and to score 95 goals, to, you know, when you look at the stats, 32 wins. We were, I think, from third and fourth place, we were 21 and 22 points better than third and fourth place, challenging for Champions League. It just shows you what Liverpool did to even contend with us this season. And at the end, I'm glad to say we won.
What do you make of Liverpool? What do you think let them down in the end? Because it has been a case of two brilliant teams, and we know about the runs at the end of the season, but why do you think Liverpool haven't won that title this year?
Well, the team that normally wins the Premiership is the team that win the most games. We won the most games. Secondly, the team that scores the most goals normally wins the Premier League. We scored the most goals. We had the clean sheet, I think, of 20. Liverpool had 21. They lost one game, and which is quite phenomenal in the Premiership over 38 games. But I've got to say, where they lost it, seven draws.
Yeah.
That's where they lost it. They could have afforded to lose two more games and draw two games and still ended up with more points than us. So it's not about in the Premiership about how many games you go undefeated. It's about how many games you win. And that was proven this season.
Pep said in the run-up to this game, actually, that he reckons they'll be even better next season, which is a terrifying thought. How? Where, what areas of this team do you think can get better?
Well, obviously, I think Nicolas Otamendi may well be looking to play more regular next season, so he may be moved on. So I think we'll be scrutinising all over. I think David Silva, who's been fantastic for us and still is that he's probably coming up to his 32nd birthday. So we'll be looking at younger, fresher. So eventually, like all the great teams, the players that have helped us to get there, unfortunately, won't be the players that will be continuing because of age and because of other factors. So players will come in and players that have helped us to get there. When you think we've got four players that played you today, they've got four titles now. You know, they've won four premierships. Aguero, Company, David Silva. I can't remember the fourth one is, but I was counting up last night. There's four players that's got four Premier Leagues.
Yeah.
So you can see we've kept the core of the side, as we did when Joe Hart was there and Vincent still there, of course. The core of the side when Yaya was there, and he got a fantastic reception yesterday from the City fans. So new players will come in. Pep will know what it is. Who are we to argue with what Pep says or does? We looked at the team again yesterday, saw Mahrez, that if you'd have asked any supporter, he would not have been the first choice on our team for yesterday because of his performance has been a little bit spasmodic. So when he was there, he was surprised, but then he turns somebody into the box, rifles one into the top corner and puts us into a comfortable lead then at 3-1. So who are we to argue what Pep says or does? And trust me, they will be working to make us stronger next season.
Vincent Kompany, you mentioned him there, you know, a guy who's been there for the best part of a decade. It looks like he's going to be walking away from the club, although Guardiola said he's going to sit down and have a beer with him. Probably sick of beer at this point, Vincent Kompany, I would have thought after last night. But do you think that they will and should look at someone like him and say, even if you're not playing every week, you're worth having in the dressing room.
Vincent Kompany played yesterday better than I've seen him play in the previous games where he was outstanding as well. Vincent Kompany's still got a lot to offer. As I said, players coming to, you know, maybe the end of their careers at Manchester City, we're looking at younger players who need to come in. That is just, that's what happens. Well, Vincent Kompany, I'll be the most surprised City fan ever if he's not with us next season, whether that's on a one-year contract or a rolling contract, whatever you want to do, but I feel that he'll be with us next season. And I'll be surprised if he's not in that squad when it's named at the start of the 2019-20 season.
In terms of the Champions League, because you know this is back-to-back Premier League titles, we know how hard that is. But what do you think City need to do to win the Champions League? Do you think it's inevitable that they will in the next couple of years?
Right, now after putting all the facts and everything else, now it sounds as though being a little bit blue-tinted glasses, but it's quite obvious, and for anybody's there, VAR's a great tool. I'm a firm believer of it. If VAR had not been there, City would have been going to the Champions League and not Tottenham. But having said that, City still might have been going to the Champions League final because without doubt it was handball with Llorente. Whichever way you had that up, it hits his hand onto his hip and goes in. Now, it's your hand in Champions League football. We've seen it. We've seen it with Otamendi when we played at Offenheim where his hand's down the side of him. It hits him on the hand. It's a penalty. We saw it with Danny Rose at Tottenham. He goes out in a position to try and block it. It hits his arm. It's a penalty. Whether it's right or wrong, we don't argue with that. But if it does hit your hand where it hits it, and it's either a penalty or it's a no-goal, then you have to stick with that. But how the referee was not shown on that instance, the angle that shows quite clearly hits him on his arm, hand onto his hip and goes in, then VAR's not being used properly. It used properly for Tottenham when all those Tottenham players fell on the floor because they thought, it's gone. A second, Sterling scored. If it had not been for VAR, we would have been going to the Champions League final and we'd have been arguing because although marginally offside, he was offside.
Yeah.
But equal as much, if you're going to use that VAR and it hits your hand and it's a penalty, it's a penalty or it's a no-goal, then you have to use that VAR. And so it happened last year with Milner. When he hits him on the thigh, Sane scores. But the officials behind the goals and the referees still don't see that. And then we look at the two goals at Anfield where Salah was offside for the first goal. It's clear this. It's not. I'm not just making it up. It's clear he was offside for the first goal, the halfway line, and Sane was not offside for a goal that we scored at Anfield. So, VAR will work and it won't work. It worked for Tottenham on this occasion. Maybe it'll work for us next season.
Gary, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations again.
My pleasure.
And I'm sure the hangover will fade quickly as the day goes on. That's Gary Owen there, former Man City midfielder who was there yesterday as they won back-to-back Premier League titles away at Brighton. Doesn't matter where you do it, it's still the big trophy.
Love sports.
Let's speak to someone who knows Brighton pretty well because he spent two different spells as a player there and he's on the line now. It's Adam Virgo. Adam, were you surprised to hear the news about Chris this morning?
No, I wasn't, to be honest. I think the only thing I was quite surprised about was how quick it was after the last game of the season. So this must have been a thought of Tony Bloom in the background thinking that, you know, the decision must be made quickly. But then on the other side of it, it now gives them time to go out and look for a manager to try and take things forward. But I thought come the end of the season when Brighton have finished their season, I wouldn't have been surprised to see Chris sacked. Ironically, I think if Brighton would have got relegated, I think he'd have had a better chance of staying as manager because I think he's an excellent Championship manager.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get rid of him in that situation, then who else in the Championship or who else outside of the Premier League is a good Championship manager? And Chris is right up there. But, listen, things haven't worked out for them this year, but his overall record at the football club, you can't look at as being a failure. I think he's been one of Brighton's most successful managers. You know, the job he's meant to do is to keep Brighton in the Premier League, which he's done. But I think the thing this season is that I haven't seen them progress on as a club and as a team. And I think that's where he came a little bit unstuck in 2019 and now why today he's out of work.
What sort of manager does Chris Hughton tend to be? You know the club pretty well. You're obviously a Brighton boy. When you speak to people who've worked with him, what kind of boss is he?
Well, if you talk to anyone in the media, no one has a bad word to say about Chris. You know, he's always very cooperative in media interviews and you know, when I've met him pitch side, he always comes over and gives me a couple of minutes of his time, and he's that kind of guy. He's really, really nice. But I've spoken to Glenn Murray, and the one thing I've said to Glenn was, like, doesn't seem like he's got a bite in him, as in he can lose his rag. And he said to me, no, trust me, he can do. He can lose it. And we do see that side of it. So that was the one thing I was looking at as a manager. Yes, when he's speaking to the press and when he's speaking to people, he comes across really nice. But I didn't know if he had that other side in him when, you know, the players need to be told or he needs to lose his temper. And you know, Glenn was like, no, he can have a bite back every now and then. But listen, the results at the end of the day, I think it's three wins in 23. And you've got that sentimental side that he's got Brighton into the Premier League and he kept them up in that first season. But the signings this year just haven't worked out for him. And it was interesting because I saw them against Tottenham away from home. And he basically started all of his signings for the first time in the season. So he played Montoya at right back, Bernardo at left back, Bissouma. And then he went with the front four of Lacadia, Yohanbash and Andone, and they were all his signings, and those signings were seeming the players to come in and take Brighton on to that next level, not necessarily to be competing for the top seven, but you know, you go up against your Burnleys and your Southamptons and your Leicesters and you kind of be more competitive against them. But his tactics haven't really changed from playing a top six side to Huddersfield at home when they only got that 1-0 win, and I think that's where the worry was. I think if you went again next season into that mentality and the way that you play, then I think Brighton will come a little bit unstuck.
Do you think there's a disconnect here? Because I look at it and I think, you know, we all know what Chris Hughton is. He's a manager, as you say, doesn't look like someone who's got a bite, but he is effective. And they've brought in Dan Ashworth as a technical director, someone who says he wants to be a conduit between the football department and the board of directors, someone who says his job is to keep Chris Hughton in there. Now, I wonder if you... They haven't signed well, Brighton. I don't think anyone would argue with that. Those signings haven't worked. Do you think that previously it was basically the manager's yay or nay, and now they're moving to a different model and they want someone different to work within that?
Yeah, I mean, the scouting system, probably in the last 5 years, they've slowly got one or two into certain positions. But at the end of the day, the manager had the final say. So predominantly in the Championship, it was a lot down to the manager, i.e. Chris, in those last 2 years.
Right.
Since they've been in the Premier League, they've tried to change the goalposts a little bit where they look a lot more in Europe. Now, I don't know if Chris's knowledge of the European market... Listen, he will know players in Europe, don't get me wrong, but yeah, all of their players are coming from Europe. Now, I don't know if he knows how to manage those players because they've come in on good reputations. You know, Lacardi came in after scoring goals and Yohanbash had come in scoring loads of goals and Bissouma had had a really good season at Lille. So they've done respectively well, but since coming to the Premier League, they haven't quite made that adjustment. So, I mean, I don't know if Chris knew that Dan Ashworth was coming in. That's what I'd heard. I think that was made without him knowing. So, Listen, Tony, I know Tony Bloom really, really well, the chairman. I know Paul Barber a little bit less, but you know, I know Tony on a personal basis, and I know today's decision would have been very, very difficult for him to make. And I think when a lot of people look at the outside and seeing what Chris has done, then people may see the sacking as very, very harsh. And you know, what do you expect Brighton to do? But if they're going to make this sacking, then they need to go in a new direction, and they need to go and sign players that maybe may cost a few more pounds, but they kind of almost guarantee you success to a certain extent, rather than trying to gamble on somebody coming in from Holland that may or may not be a success. Because you look in that first season when they signed Pascal Gross, $2.5 million they paid for him. I think he got seven goals and 9 assists in the first season, and he was fantastic. But the second season, he couldn't quite go on from that. And you're not always going to get those kind of signings that come in on a cheaper wage and a cheaper value and get a 60, 70 million pound result. I mean, Lewis Dunk's going to be a massive situation now in the summer, because if they lose him, then they're going to be in trouble. But I just think the direction they need to go to, if they're going to go into Europe, then I feel a European manager has to be right, even though Tony Bloom's last two managers from Europe, Oscar Garcia and Sammy Hupia, didn't quite work out very well.
Certainly be interesting to see who they do get in. The bookies are currently scrambling around with some names from the bottom of the barrel, but I don't believe any of them. Adam, time's catching up with us, but thank you so much for coming on, giving us your expert insight to the situation at Brighton. That's former Brighton defender Adam Virgo.
This is Love Sport.
Really interesting to hear Adam there, a man who knows Brighton very, very well, both as a town and as a club, obviously two different spells playing there. It's interesting, I think, to think about this Chris Hughton sacking, because it seems to have divided opinion. My immediate reaction was, that's pretty unlucky. I know that they only just avoided relegation in the Premier League, and they went on a bad run at the end of the season. But you still have to think about what they're going to achieve under anyone else. They've spent about £120 million in the last two seasons, and their most expensive signing, I think, is Jahanbakhsh at 17. Yeah, has he been successful? No. Izquierdo, 16 million. Successful? No. Yves Bissouma, 15 million. Close. In spells, but probably not. Jürgen Lacardia, no. Rafael Dwamina at £12 million. You know, they haven't solved this striker problem. Glenn Murray scored 13 goals in the league this season, and God bless him, he's a great player and he's a brilliant servant to football. But he's not going to do that again. And if he does, it'll have bucked a trend, because most 35-year-olds tend to decline at some point. And they can't rely on that. Because if they play like that again next season, they'll get relegated. So I understand it from that point of view. But there is a running trend here with Chris Hughton. Norwich was 17th when he got sacked. Not great, I admit, but they got one more point all season and were relegated to the Championship. Didn't seem to have much impact sacking him then. Newcastle were 12th in the Premier League when Chris Hughton got sacked. If you think that's easy to achieve, it's then a position they probably would have dreamed of 4 years later. Frankly, for that club, it was a very respectable position. They were going all right. Now, he's kept Brighton in the Premier League. He showed, I think, what they can do with a bit of freedom when they went to Arsenal the other week. And he's been sacked. I think if they want to play different football, they can say to him, right, we're going to sign this player, and this player, play a different style of football. They brought in Dan Ashworth, right, who's the technical director who takes a lot of credit for what was done at Brighton, and rightly so. But he's come in, and he said, incidentally, he describes the role as the conduit between the board and the football department. So now you know what a technical director is. It's the filter between the board of directors and the footballing operations in the club. When he first got the role, he said, my job is to try and keep the first team manager in a job for as long as possible. Well, he's failed at that pretty early on. And he said when he came in, I wanted to make sure Chris was comfortable with it, and then it was a no-brainer. So everything about this suggests that Dan has come in and gone, yeah, Chris Hooton's a guy I like. It works. I think we should work with Chris Hughton. Why not? But then you look at the players they've signed and you say, well, is this really Chris Hughton's fault? They've signed poorly. The signings have performed poorly. And he's managed to keep them in the Premier League, which is not an easy thing to do. Just ask Norwich, relegated three times in the last 10 years. It's hard to do this. Now, I think you could have sat down with Chris, with Dan, and said, look, this is how we're going to move forward. Chris, we think you're a good coach. Great. You know the club well. Obviously, at some point, everything has to come to an end. But you have to wonder, are they holding him responsible for all these signings? And if so, did he really make them all? Because the fact that they've changed the way they're working suggests to me that he didn't. Suggests to me that they've looked at what they've done and said, oh, well, actually, the way we were signing before doesn't quite work, so we'll bring Dan in and do it differently. Surely then you don't need to sack the manager because you've identified the problem, which is the system under which you sign these players. I don't really understand that, I'm afraid. Maybe we'll never know. Maybe we'll never get full clarity over the way that was done. But I feel for Chris Hughton because for the third time in his career, I look at his sacking and think, is that quite right? By the way, it's yet another black manager sacked in English football. I don't know if there's a trend, but it certainly looks that way this season. We know there aren't many black managers in English football. And there is a suggestion that the two might be linked. Perhaps not consciously, in fact, almost certainly not consciously, but it seems Darren Moore lost his job this year. Extremely harshly, a lot of people said. Chris Powell lost his job this year. Reasonably harshly, too. Now Chris Hughton's lost his job as well. You've got to wonder whether there is some sort of link here. I don't know. I hope that Darren Moore is not out of work for long, an outstanding manager. I hope that Chris Hughton is not out of work for very long, a very experienced and talented manager. Similarly, Chris Powell. But who knows? At this point, I don't know what's right in football anymore.
Love sport.
Speaking of people who need to get decisions right, Manchester United are going to have a busy old summer this summer. And one of those people whose name is very much in question, whose future is very cloudy and unclear, is Alexis Sanchez. I don't think anyone could deny he's had a difficult season. I think that might be the understatement of the century, actually. The Chilean has probably been hoping that his first full season at United might be a breakthrough moment. He had a full pre-season to get himself nice and fit, to earn the trust of a manager, to find his best position at the club, and then stamp his name on that number 7 shirt. That number 7 shirt, by the way, which is starting to look like a curse. Since Ronaldo and Beckham, they've had Michael Owen, Valencia, Memphis Depay, and now Alexis Sanchez. That number 7 shirt's not looking good. But I feel for Sanchez, because Jose Mourinho said he had an attitude problem. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has said he needs to get himself right before there's only so much he can do for him. They're not ringing endorsements, are they, from a manager about a player who's only been at the club a year and a bit and is obviously struggling. So I want to give Sanchez himself a bit of credit. He's had a terrible season on the pitch. We can all see that. But frankly, he's come out and admitted it. He came out on Instagram after the season finally finished. And credit for not doing it during the season, I suppose, because maybe that could disrupt a team. But he said on Instagram, it was a very tough season and the fans are the ones who deserve an apology, as they always support you no matter what happens. Personally, I didn't perform as much as I was expecting because of unpredictable injuries. Press and people were speculating of things that were not even true. Now, we know Alexis Sanchez had a difficult season on the pitch, and we hear he's had a difficult season off the pitch with various personal breakups and the like. There's no doubt those two things are linked. That's what happens in your life. All these things tend to be linked, whether it's mental or physical issues. If your body can't recover, your brain can't recover. And if your brain can't recover, your body can't recover. So you have to try and give Alexis Sanchez some leeway and also a bit of credit for his honesty to come out and say, yeah, I was bad. But he says, I was always professional in all aspects. I apologise to the fans for not being able to achieve our goals. Players and staff are questioning if we do the right thing and if we are giving our best for this football club. I'm certain that Manchester United will one day return to be the club as it was in the old days with Sir Alex Ferguson. I really like it. I don't necessarily like the sort of shadow of Fergie, which United have been playing under ever since he retired. But I do like that Sanchez has bucked the trend here. So often players come out, especially at the end of a season, or actually more likely their social media team comes out and says, thanks to the fans for all your support, we'll be back next year working hard. And it's meaningless. But when Sanchez comes out and says, yeah, we have been bad, and yeah, people have been asking a lot of questions, but we're working hard and we're doing our best, I kind of respect that. Kind of respect the acceptance that the performance isn't good enough. And Sanchez, you know, is admitting that he hasn't played well enough. He doesn't need to tell us. It's plainly obvious to anyone who's ever watched football and seen him play. But he's trying to own his mistake a bit. And we know he's a bit of a loner. We know he's someone who struggles to settle a bit. And while he was very settled at Arsenal, he then all of a sudden wasn't in Manchester. Frankly, Mourinho's United might have been the worst possible situation for him to move into. Because Mourinho has a carrot and a stick. Although, unfortunately, his carrot is like his stick in that it's a stick, just bigger and pointier. His management technique is stick and stick, as opposed to carrot and stick. And someone like Sanchez was never going to respond well to that. And I'm a little bit disappointed that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer isn't coming out and saying, oh, you know, I remember Sanchez at Arsenal. He was a brilliant player. And doing that, as Brian Clough said, making him feel 10 foot tall for a bit. I think Sanchez really needs someone like that. And I sort of think the player that he was at Arsenal, I think there could be managers out there who want to take a risk on him. United are going to have to pay for the rest of his contract. Quite a lot of it. If they want to get rid of him this summer, they're probably going to have to still pay half his wages until the end of this current deal. It's the only way that they're going to get rid of him. This isn't uncommon in football. It's called paying up the contract, and they'll probably have to do it. Which means that Sanchez won't have to take the pay cut, but he will be able to hawk himself to other clubs and say, you only have to pay 60% of these wages. And if you're a manager and you look at him and think, why not take a punt on Alexis Sanchez? Brian Clough did it so well. He used to say, right, we'll get this player. He's got some problems. Let's fix those problems and then we'll get the player that he was. Now, I don't know what these unpredictable injuries are, but I suspect that they might not just be in his legs and they might be in his head as well. Certainly they will be affecting him mentally, because that's what injuries do. It's the flip side of them. It always is. And if I were a manager who wanted to play high-intensity football and who wanted to come out and say, you know what, I'm going to take a punt on this player, who wanted to give him a two-year contract and build him up again, make him feel 100 feet tall again. If I were Jurgen Klopp, the type of manager who can work with players who've had those injury problems, who is able to motivate them and say to them, you need to stay here, we can work with you. Why is Daniel Sturridge still at Liverpool? Because of Jurgen Klopp. Why has Divock Origi come back from that horrible injury against Everton, come back from a dreadful loan spell against Wolfsburg? Because of Jurgen Klopp. Why is this Liverpool team staying together so well and showing such remarkable spirit? He may not have won very much, Jurgen Klopp, but one thing he does do is people. He's a people manager. And that's the great skill of modern football management. I don't think Alexis Sanchez is that far away from being a great player again. I'd certainly like to see Jurgen Klopp try and find out.
Love Sport.
You might not have noticed this weekend, but there was cricket going on. Plenty of it as well. It might have got lost in all the noise of all the football, the F1, that bloke jumping over the line in the 400-metre hurdles, all of it. But Joss Butler was doing what Joss Butler always does. It sort of felt like another game, another Joss Butler 100. Love Sport's Guy Watts joins me to discuss yet another unbelievable Joss Butler innings.
Am I? I thought I was here for the football.
No,
the
absolutely football. Not. Someone's got to talk about Joss Butler scoring 100 or 50 balls.
There's all the football and forever to play it in, as that Mitchell and Webb sketch so memorably put it. Yeah, Joss Butler, so unlucky, I suppose, to choose that weekend to do it, although you would argue that anything that anyone does in English cricket terms at the moment is going to matter so much less than when the World Cup starts in a couple of weeks' time. That's all it is now, just a couple of weeks away. But yeah, another just incredible innings. It seems like just a few weeks, it was a few months now, but since he was doing remarkable things in the Caribbean as well, 150 off 77 balls he got out there, 100 he brought up off 50 balls against Pakistan at the weekend, finished 110 not out off 55. The guy just keeps breaking records. You know, he's been doing it for so long now, and when he first came into the England team and scored his first couple of hundreds, they were at speeds that we'd never seen English players do before. You know, we'd seen it from Indian players or West Indian players, players of most nationalities actually, but never from an English player, or if it did happen, it was a real freak, a one-off innings. And Butler's now got 8 one-day hundreds. I would wager that they are all at much quicker than a runner ball, except that innings against Australia in the fifth ODI last summer that was much more sedate. It was, of course, in a collapsing team where he ended up sort of winning it with just one wicket to spare with Jake Ball at the other end. And that was arguably the finest innings of them all. So that tells you just how diverse, how versatile a player he is in that sense as well. But this innings, sorry, I got distracted. To get back to the one on Saturday, I mean, look, when you set a platform of 200 for three or whatever it was in the 35th over and you got Joss Butler to come out, you might as well pack up and go home as a bowling team.
I mean, he was also aided by the fact that he came in and Yasir Shah bowled him three deliveries that I might have hit for six in his first four, which I think he hit two sixes and a two because he clunked one of them. But also, when you look at the fastest hundreds by Englishmen in ODI cricket, Joss has five of the top 10, including four of the top seven. I mean, it's completely absurd how far ahead of any other English cricketer possibly ever he is. Now, it's hard to compare eras because we are now in a time when if you score a one-day 100 and it's slower than the runner ball, it's not really
useful.
It will, precisely, but it's not very useful to your team because there are other people who could have scored those runs at much faster rates. But in terms of the modern era, he is, I think, the best one-day batsman England have ever had. And you were saying that Nasser Hussain is sort of putting him in echelons even beyond that.
The very, very top echelons, exactly. When Nasser says things, unlike a lot of pundits in a lot of sports, he doesn't say things for the headline. He says things because he really, really means them. He's thought it through. And he name-checked three other players and said Butler is worth at least talking about in that bracket. And the bracket is the one that is belonged to by Virat Kohli, AB de Villiers and Viv Richards. There'd be a couple of other names to throw into that mix. Maybe Rohit Sharma would be deserving of a place in that very top sort of echelon as well. Joss Butler, I am a massive fan of Joss Butler. I've, you know, been since before he was even playing for England, just loved watching him play for Somerset. What he could do off 10 balls at the back end of a 2020 innings at the age of sort of 19 or 20 was honestly sort of tough to believe when you were watching English 2020 cricket and an English batsman doing it. I think he will be in that bracket at the end of his career. I hope he will be. I think at 28, I hope there's a lot to come, I suppose, is why I'm just a little bit hesitant to kind of go all out and agree with Nasser, because he's done incredible things. but he could do so much more. 8 centuries is incredible, given that he's probably not made any of them batting above number 5 when all those other 3 players are top 3 or 4 batsmen. He probably could do it in the top 3 or 4. It's arguably a more impressive skill to be able to do it coming in low down. A, you've obviously got less time, and B, the field is obviously much less to your advantage. It's kind of a lot easier to score big runs and big runs quickly at the start of the innings. The ball's harder, it travels faster, and they're only allowed 2 fielders out on the boundary for the first 10 overs at the very least. They're all back.
I was going to ask you a question about this, because he, in his 129 ODI innings, he's batted in the top 4 9 times. In that time, he's got 200s and a 90. That's a pretty phenomenal strike rate in that position. Is it fair, is it right for him to be batting outside of the top 4 when he's so clearly our most talented batsman?
I think it's a really interesting debate, because for a long time he was batting 6 or even 7 in England's one day team, and it was just ludicrous. It was just madness. You couldn't understand why. I don't care if he's keeping wicket, I don't care if he's keeping wicket, opening the bowling as well. He is clearly a batsman who should be playing at the very least in the top 5. I'm surprised actually that his numbers are that good at number 4. My impression is that he bats there normally when we've had an incredible start and we've maybe only got, say, 15 or fewer overs left when we lose our second wicket, and we say, right, we don't want to risk Joss not getting in at all, we'll send him in now. And that actually, under that little bit of extra pressure, if you like, not that he often suffers under pressure in a run chase, for example, but he doesn't actually do the incredible things that we expect of him. So the fact that he's got 200s in 9 innings there makes you think that maybe that is something that we should think about. I know it's at the 11th hour when it comes to the World Cup. Owen Morgan would be a mighty fine player to have come in at number 5, you know, to have them both at the crease at the end of the innings. I think I saw on Twitter someone say this is how every one day international innings should end. It shouldn't be forgotten that Owen Morgan played another fantastic innings, 80 odds on Saturday. In the last year, or since last July rather, in one day internationals, he's averaged over 100, if you can believe that. So many not out scores at the back end of innings. He's finally regained that kind of magic touch he had a bit earlier in his career that he's seen to lose for a couple of years.
Yeah, this Butler thing is interesting, and just looking at those innings where he does get promoted to 4, generally it is 35 overs gone, Joss isn't in yet, probably should get him in. But even on the one occasion he came in the 17th over, he still got 100, and that seems to be, it doesn't matter where you put him, he's going to get.
Well, it's been
runs.
Interesting. Remember, he in the last, I would say it's just the last year or so, because remember the big turning point in Butler's career, even a year ago he wasn't back in the test team. He was still just a white ball player when it came to England. He was our test player of the year last year. You know, no one scored more test runs for Butler since he came back into the test team last summer. It was opening the batting for the Rajasthan Royals in the IPL, where he was probably the overseas player of the tournament last year, that got him back in the England Red Bull setup, ironically, and also saw him promoted to the top of the England order in 2020 internationals. The idea was, there is so little time in 2020s that to have Butler not in there for the as much as possible is wrong. So you sort of think, well, why not apply the same logic to 50 over cricket? You could say, well, he keeps wicket, the argument that's used against Bairstow batting too high in tests, but you say, well, Gilchrist did pretty well opening the batting for Australia and keeping wicket. It's a completely different game. It's 100 overs in a day, job done. Butler is a supreme athlete. He and Ben Stokes, you hear all the time about the amount of physical training they do on top of all the other cricket practice. And they're right at the peak of their careers, tops of their games. I have no doubt that Butler could open and keep wicket. You don't want to fiddle too much with a winning team, I know, and Johnny Bairstow did fantastic in the IPL. Jason Roy's record for England is brilliant, and Joe Root is, I would argue, the one slightly old-fashioned or more traditional type of player that really can justify being picked still in modern white ball cricket. But at number 4, Owen Morgan or Joss Butler, it's a nice decision to have to make, but I think you'd want Butler facing more balls than Morgan.
For sure. Things looking quite rosy for England in that sense. They left out James Vince on Saturday, much to the chagrin of most Hampshire fans who didn't get the chance to see either Jofra Archer or their beloved James Vince down at the Rose Bowl. But
saw a few runs, though.
Yeah, I mean, not too disappointed. We've got 700 runs in a day or whatever it was. So he was released to go and play for Hampshire, got 80-odd in their semi-final victory. A game as remarkable for what Vince did. He's in good form, we know this, and has basically confirmed his place in the World Cup squad with that, but also because of what happened to Jimmy Anderson. Had a ball smashed back at him by James Fuller, who did his best to give England's Ashes hopes a blow. Bone bruising, is that the implication?
Well, I think it's a bit early to say. I'm certainly not a doctor. I have no medical qualifications. Very few at all.
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah.
That would be the worry. I think bruising, plain and simple, would be what you hope is the outcome. It certainly looked a nasty blow. It struck him on the inside of the left knee by the look of things, maybe flicked off the right knee as well. It was hit very hard, and it was a worrying sight. It was difficult to tell. I think it was Mark Butcher on commentary was sort of saying, oh, I think he's all right, sort of hopefully, and with that sort of laugh that you sometimes put on when you really hope something is a lot less serious than it could be.
He limped off and couldn't complete the over.
You've got to think that even if it was a very minor scare, they would have taken that precaution with England and all the rest of it in mind, that Jimmy Anderson would have forced them to take that precaution, even if Lancashire wanted him to stay out there. Let's not scaremonger where it's not necessary, but it's a reminder, I suppose, that England's Ashes hopes do rest a lot on James Anderson, and that, as ever in sport, you are a split second away from some terrible piece of misfortune changing the entire outlook of a sporting contest. And let's be honest, with Alistair Cook gone from the team and in the last couple of years obviously not the player he was, James Anderson is unequivocally the most important player probably to any team in Test cricket at the moment. So to lose him would be a shocking blow to England. It'd be terrible luck for him and the national team. Let's hope that's not the case. And just a reminder how quickly things can change, I suppose. You know, if David Warner were to, say, twist his ankle on a rugby ball in a warm-up at Edgbaston before the first test, that would be unfortunate as well.
It would be hugely unfortunate because it would deprive us of the opportunity to give out, I think, will be one of the biggest campaigns of abuse ever seen in English cricket.
Friendly abuse.
Sort of friendly. I don't know. But it also calls into question, Jimmy Anderson's now played 6 List A games in the last 3 weeks. He's a man of, what, 36, pushing 37. Massive summer for him. Possibly his last English cricket summer. Is it right that he's going out and playing in these games all the time?
I know where you're coming from. I actually think that the way James Anderson has been managed by both England and Lancashire over the last few years has been a fantastically well-organised arrangement. You know, he has peaked really every time he's played for England, whether that's at home or away in conditions that favour him and ones that don't. I wouldn't say I'm qualified to be sort of passing judgment on whether or not it's right. These workloads will have been very, very carefully looked at. He will have been consulted. I'm sure he won't be playing in things that he was adamant he didn't want to play in. You've got to strike the balance, however good you are, however long you've been doing it, between keeping your hand in, so to speak, and making sure you're fully rested. These one-day games, he's bowling a maximum of 10 overs at a time. Yes, he's 36, but I think he's probably fitter or as fit as pretty much anyone in that England setup. Just look at him. There's nothing spare on him. So it doesn't worry me, plain and simple, that he's playing in those games. It worries me to see him limping off from one of them before being able to complete one of his own. Let's hope it's nothing serious.
Yeah, fingers crossed and knees crossed in Jimmy's case.
Love sports.
Now, as you know, we have a little regular bit on the James Gray Show, where we go through some of the things you might have missed from the weekend's sporting action. Arsene, what was your favourite bit of the game last night?
I didn't see it.
But you must have seen some funny moments in the game.
I didn't see it.
All right, what about that new Zac Efron film?
I didn't see it.
Well, at least I was watching, Arsene. I was. I was watching all 10 games from throughout the Premier League. No, I mean, I was trying anyway. I had my eyes all over the place. And there were plenty of little weird moments going on, I think it's fair to say. It's easy to get a little bit overexcited when you win the Premier League title. Of course, I wouldn't know because I'm a Liverpool fan and I've never won the Premier League, but I imagine it's pretty exciting. And for a couple of City fans, it was all a bit much for them. They broke their shackles and sprinted onto the pitch. Naturally, the stewards were quick to respond, caught up with them and just reminded them of the rules about running onto the pitch in the way that only football stewards can. Yeah, with a knee in the small of the back. One of the fans saw Pep walking over to the City end and shouted, "I love you, Pep," or something like that. Pep smiled back and gave him the thumbs up while he had his face pressed further into the turf by a steward. I'm sure he was given a little bit more of a reminder by the steward for his impertinence.
I didn't see it.
Now, Pep Guardiola's demanding nature means that it never stops. They conceded this goal to Glenn Murray. Pep Guardiola equalised, Sergio Aguero equalised. Pep Guardiola did not score, but for 83 seconds they were staring down the barrel of this like heartbreaking final day defeat. Guardiola was not interested in letting another goal in. The first one came, perhaps predictably, from a set piece. Brighton won it, and then Glenn Murray got the goal. So when City gave away another free kick in dangerous range, Guardiola absolutely lost it. He walked back to the bench, kicks his seat in anger, because he knew that all this hard work, or everything that he'd done, this whole season, could come down to an inability to not give away fouls in dangerous areas. It didn't cost them, but it's Guardiola's little reminder of the fine margins that the Premier League can come down to.
I didn't see it.
I get that if you're an Everton fan, you haven't always got a lot to celebrate. Vinny Samways' winner in the 1995 Charity Shield final probably feels like quite a long time ago. It is, that's why it feels like it. It is a long time ago. 24 years it is since Everton last won anything. So the final day of the season is more often than not involves inflatables, flip-flops, shorts, sun cream, a bit of fun on a Sunday afternoon. And yet yesterday, Everton fans spent the whole day singing about Tottenham and Man City. They were singing about Tottenham because they might be able to stop Liverpool winning the Champions League. And they were singing about Man City because they could stop Liverpool winning the Premier League. In the Everton end at the Spurs Stadium, there was a bloke in a Sterling mask holding a Man City flag while the whole away end sang Blue Moon. Is that really what Everton Football Club has come to? Celebrating their rivals not winning the league, you know, despite the fact they're 35 points behind the whole thing. It's pathetic.
I didn't see it.
I was in Manchester yesterday and I was getting the train back in the evening with a lot of quite miserable Manchester United fans. I'm not going to say I enjoyed it, but it was rather funny. And there were three young lads running up and down the train, clearly all being bought the away kit for that year, you know, the dark navy blue one. Three boys, sort of descending ages, as children tend to be. So the first one, Rashford 10 on the back. I thought, oh, okay, yeah, good player, that's decent. Second one, Rashford 10 on the back. And I was like, oh, I see, they've all got the same player on the back. Third one, Lindelof. Who on earth? That's irresponsible parenting, that is. Getting your kid a shirt with Victor Lindelof, a centre-half who only recently has started to look like he knows how to play football. That is poor parenting. I almost reported them to social services.
I didn't see it.
And finally, you may have seen Phil Foden. I have to come back to the champions because they are the champions today. Phil Foden posted a tweet of himself with the Premier League trophy and Noel Gallagher in the dressing room at Brighton yesterday. It was entitled Champagne Football, Champagne Supernova. I thought, oh, that's quite sweet. And then I thought about it. And I was like, how much does Phil Foden really know about Oasis? Because Phil Foden was born on May the 28th in the year 2000, by which time Noel Gallagher had already had five UK number ones. It's actually more likely that Phil Foden was conceived to one of Oasis's big hits than he ever owned one of their CDs. Actually, Phil Foden probably doesn't even know what a CD is. I'm not sure Noel Gallagher cares.
Honestly, during the game, I didn't see.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to The James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can listen to the show live on Love Sport Radio every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30.